The monologue, and Mary Ellen Campbell is going to play the role of the concubine of the Levite.
I would tell you my name, but the Bible never gave me the dignity of having one. Still, my story is recorded here in the book of Judges, chapter 19, and for that I am grateful. The story of my life, or should I say my death, begins in a time when there were as yet no kings to rule the 12 tribes of Israel, so there was great chaos throughout the land. The leader Moses was dead, and Joshua, his successor, also. It was a time of uncertainty for our people. 12 different judges had tried to rise up from each of the 12 tribes and bring order to the chaos, but the people did not listen to these tribal chiefs, not Deborah, nor Gideon, nor Samson. It was a time when my people refused to follow the ways of God, and the moral fabric of the people had completely disintegrated. Everyone just did whatever seemed right to them. Perhaps you are living in a time like that too. And so it was in that time of little regard for the ways of God that I was made the concubine of a man from the priestly tribe of Levi. He refused to give me the dignity and status and security of a marriage, but I was expected to perform the duties of both a slave and a wife. After some time with him, I grew angry with his treatment of me. I believed that my life should be more than it was. He was so jealous and accused me of being unfaithful. So in utter desperation, I ran away from him and returned to the home of my father. I felt safer there in my childhood home in Bethlehem than I ever did with my so-called husband. After 4 months had passed, I was just beginning to feel at peace again when the Levite appeared at my father's door. He told me that he loved me and wanted me to go back with him. But I didn't want to go back to those isolated hills. But he spoke so tenderly to me, telling me that things would be different this time, and I really wanted to believe him. There was a tenderness that I had never seen, and he had journeyed all this way for me. I wanted to believe him, but yet I didn't trust that my husband would treat me any better than he had before. I didn't want to go back, and I told my father so. Every night, after plying my husband with food and wine, my father would manage to convince my husband to stay yet another night. It seemed that perhaps my father was trying to stall him from taking me away, and I loved my father for it. But the other part of me resented my father. Why didn't my father protect me from this man? Instead, my father seemed to enjoy my husband's company, impressed that he had come after me. The two men would stay up laughing and talking and getting along, eating and drinking until the wee hours of the morning. I was confused. But then, after the fourth night, I could see that my husband just wanted to return home. And so I packed up my things and went with him. I didn't feel that I had a choice. It wasn't in my power to say no. My life was in the hands of these two men. And so that day we traveled the long journey home until we came to a small town outside of Jerusalem. But it was a city filled with Jebusites, foreigners that my husband didn't trust. He decided that we should not stop overnight there because it wouldn't be safe. He told the servant boy that he only wanted to stay in a town full of Israelites. And so that is why we went on until we came to Gibeah, which was settled by the tribe of Benjamin. When we arrived in Gibeah, it was already getting late. We waited in the city square in hopes of someone inviting us to stay the night with them, but no one did. Then just when we thought We would have to stay the night outside in the city square. An old man who still followed the laws of hospitality to strangers invited us home to dine with him, to feed our donkeys, and offer us food and lodging. That night, as we were eating, some men came and pounded on the door, demanding that my husband come out so that they could violate him. I was terrified. The old man refused to send my husband out, but instead offered his daughter, who had never been with a man, and offered me to the angry men outside. I was horrified that this old man, who had been so hospitable to us, would do such a thing. But tragically, I wasn't at all surprised when my husband pushed me out the door to be violated by all these men. I'm glad he at least had the decency to spare the girl, rather that he would throw me to the wolves and that innocent child. I still have flashbacks of those men gathered around me, so much anger and hate in their eyes. They beat me until I could no longer see, and they raped me one after the other all night long until I fell into unconsciousness. In the morning when I came to, I don't know how I did it, but I managed to find enough strength in my spirit to drag myself to the door and knock. I heard the door open, and I heard my husband tell me harshly to get up, that we were leaving. There was no remorse, no regret, no tenderness in his voice. I didn't have the strength to go on. Somewhere deep inside me, I knew that death was far better than life, and so I gave up my spirit and I died. I am told that after my death, my husband was so angry that these men did this, even though it was my husband who allowed this to happen, that when he took my body back home to Ephraim, he took out a knife and he cut my poor, bruised body into 12 pieces. And then he packaged up each of my 12 body parts and sent a member of my body with a message to each of the leaders of the 12 tribes of Israel so that they would be outraged that the Benjaminites would dare to do such a thing to another member of their clan. And each tribe was so horrified by what the Benjaminites had done that they all went to war against them in vengeance and wiped them all out. Every last man, every last woman, every last child. But please, I don't want you to have pity on me. I want you to give me a voice. Millions of women before and after me have had to endure this kind of violence every day, in every country, in every era. Down through the centuries, humans have killed other humans relentlessly, and it needs to stop. So please, I don't want your pity or even your outrage or your horror, but I do need you to tell my story, not to overlook it or forget it. And then whatever time you live in and wherever you live, I ask you to do your part to speak out against violence. Then I know I will not have died in vain, and neither will anyone else who has died at the hands of violence. Promise me, you will speak out. Please.
You know that I usually begin with a joke, but it feels disrespectful today after the very difficult reading that we just heard. We have been reflecting on the Bible as comedy, tragedy, and fairy tale. And this morning we are facing one of the most tragic passages in all of the Judeo-Christian scripture, what American theologian Phyllis Trible refers to as one of the texts of terror, the story of the Levite's concubine in a little-known book called Judges, chapter 19. And we just heard her story beautifully told by Mary Ellen this morning. She speaks for so many nameless people throughout history who have died at the hands of violence. And you might wonder, why would we have to come to church and listen to such a dreadful story as this? And I too find it difficult to talk about such tragic stories. And yet, is it not the role as followers of Christ to also share a prophetic voice against the violence that is within us and all around us, to love those who seek to hurt us, and to be makers always of peace. And so today we are grappling with the text of terror and pausing to reflect on the violence that consumed not only Israel at this time in history, but consumes all of human civilization and consumes our media now in this so-called modern age. So what are we to do? Where is the hope? Where is God in all of this violence? As our Bible study group this last Wednesday discovered, it wasn't easy to find the Spirit of God in this story. But still, the Spirit was present, and there is some hope. We found God in the voice of the one who asks us to speak out against the violence of our culture and time. So first, we find the holy in our courage to speak out against what we have become. We are not to put our heads in the sand or avoid the violence that is within us as much as we would like to, but to acknowledge and own how violent a culture we are. Now, we Canadians, we like to think of ourselves as having a reputation for being peacemakers throughout the world. Isn't that true? And compared to so many countries, we are not a warring country. Yet we need to face the reality that our history is not blameless when it comes to violence. Last summer, Rain and I toured the tunnels of Moose Jaw. Anybody ever toured the tunnels of Moose Jaw? Yeah, and to our horror, we learned about the history of the hundreds of Chinese immigrants who came to Canada looking for a better life at the turn of the 20th century, only to end up living like slaves underneath the ground of Moose Jaw, doing the citizens' laundry, sleeping squeezed three to a bed, earning barely enough money to pay for scraps of food, and finding little to send home to their wives and families. Often they would be underneath in those tunnels for 10 years or more. Or what about the Japanese Canadians interred in camps who lost their homes in World War II? And now, because of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, generations of Canadians are finally learning about the atrocities of the residential schools and our own First Nations Holocaust that has been ignored in our history books for years. It is important that we face these stories about the violence in our own nation, not to mention the violence in our video games that our children play, in the movies that we watch and call entertainment, in the toys for boys that we purchase, the violence in the social media as millions can witness beheadings, the gang violence that is in our own cities. A couple of nights ago, Rain's dad is visiting with us, and we were visiting with Bill's friends, and Ron shared with us that his daughter, who is teaching youth in the high schools in Toronto, teaches a special class for troubled youth who have already been convicted of violent crimes, 14, 15, 16-year-olds, old, and how their whole world is filled with little except violence. She described how she would walk down the streets with the 14-year-old in the neighborhood, and they make bird-like calls to one another so all the gang members know where everyone is at all times. It is their way of survival in Toronto. And in 2015, this is going back over 4 years, police finally recorded, they put all the database together on all the computers of those reports of people missing in Canada. And in 2015, it was all added up, there are 71,000 reports of missing people in Canada. 45,000 of them children and 26,000 adults. And British Columbia has the highest number of missing persons. A little over a year ago, a young woman came into our church looking for help. And so we gave her help with food, and she had a healing treatment. 3 weeks later, she was reported missing and is now presumed dead by the hands of violence. And on this island alone, there are 1,000 calls a week that come in on the crisis line that have to do with family violence. We need to acknowledge that as Canadians, we are not immune to the violence in our world, and that we Canadians are both victims and perpetrators of violence. So the first step of healing we must make is to acknowledge and come to terms with the violence that is within us and all around us. And that's what we're doing today. And secondly, it is important that when we individually hear these stories of violence that people share with us, that we pay attention and we listen to the pain of the people who share the story. It's important that when people share with us the violence that they have experienced as children or as adults, that we believe them and that we affirm their story. If people tell us they are afraid of someone or that someone is hurting them, we need to listen. So many children have shared stories of abuse with adults and have not been believed, and their cries for help go ignored. Whether you are a child or an adult, it takes great honesty and courage to admit, even to oneself, that someone you love and trust is hurting you. And so it's important that when someone has the courage to speak out, that they are believed and their pain and their fear is affirmed. So much pain in our world could be ameliorated if people who are experiencing violence were believed. What a world of difference it would have made to our Bible story if the woman's father had believed his daughter who ran away to him and taken steps to protect her. By her very act of returning home, she was speaking out, even if she never said a word. Thirdly, the good news is that we humans are exceptionally resilient. When someone does believe and honor our story, we begin to heal. Our human spirit is capable of so much inner strength. Every day, people who have undergone incredible hardship transcend their victimization and go on to live healthy and whole lives. We human beings have a deep capacity for healing our hearts and our spirits. It takes tremendous courage to heal our pain. But healing is inevitable when we begin the process of therapy and other healing arts. And finally, what ultimately heals us as individuals and as a people is when we are able to forgive our perpetrators. Forgiveness is the final step of healing the violence in any society. Forgiveness, and when I say forgiveness, I'm not saying condoning. I'm saying forgiveness is the only act that can ever break the cycle of violence. As long as there is unforgiveness percolating, violence in a society is perpetuated. Forgiveness is what finally heals Jesus and releases him from the cross and gives way to the whole power of the resurrection. When he says from the cross, "Forgive them, they know not what they do," it releases him from the cross and he rises. Forgiving those who have hurt us enables the victim to rise up and no longer be the victim, but the victor over their own pain and suffering. Forgiveness is what ultimately allows the perpetrator to forgive themselves and helps them begin to address the pain that led to their violent behavior in the first place. Forgiveness heals both the victim and the perpetrator. Our human capacity to forgive, to choose love, is the greatest sign of strength, not weakness, and has the power to heal the individual and our nation. I always thought when, who was the man, I can't remember his name, he was going to be the judge, a Supreme Court judge in the U.S. Thank you, Kavanaugh. And a victim of his as a young boy at 16 spoke out. And I always thought, what would have healed that whole situation is if Kavanaugh had the courage to say, you know what? I was so out of it at that party. I don't remember doing this. But if you say I did that, I believe you and I am sorry. I should never have done that. And I apologize and I'm sorry and please forgive me for being a stupid, foolish, angry 16-year-old boy. Would that not have healed the whole situation? It could have. Truth and grace is what heals. It's when we put the truth underneath and try to say something didn't happen that unforgiveness and hurt continues. But when we speak the truth and offer grace, healing can happen. In our Bible study, we discovered that where God was most powerfully present in this tragic story was in the question that the old man in the city square of Gibeah, who offers them hospitality, asked the couple, the woman, who he doesn't know is victim, and her husband, the perpetrator. Here's the question. It is a profound question that I would ask for all of us to leave and work on this week. Where do you come from? And where are you going? Where do you come from? And where are you going? Perhaps if they had pondered this question, the outcome of their lives may have been different. If the people who had acted so violently against them had stopped to reflect on this question, their violence would not have overtaken them. And so I ask you this same profound question to ponder throughout the coming days. I ask you to reflect on this question as an individual and as a community of faith. Where do you come from? And where are you going? Where do you come from? What has been your story up to this point? Have you been a victim of violence? What in you needs healing? Have you been a perpetrator of violence? What in you needs healing? Are you both? What has been the learnings of this lifetime so far? And where are you going? Have you had the courage to heal your life? If not, can you find the courage now that you need to heal? Where are we going as a community of faith? To what purpose is God calling Knox at this crossroad in the history of this people? On March 3rd, we will be gathering to hear what we have discovered in all of our interviews about who we are and where we need to go. And as we ponder this question, where do you come from and where are you going? I invite you to remember that as Jesus reminded all of us, we come from God and we return to God. I close with this true story. There was a person who had been a warrior in the Middle Ages and had killed numerous people on the front purely out of a sense of duty and obligation for king and for country. And he had lived a life of violence as a soldier because that is what he was trained to do and be. That is the way it was, and he did not question it until he died. And when he crossed over and entered into the light and was reflecting on his life, he realized that he had it all wrong. Once he was in the light, bathed in this light of love, he was told that he had forgotten why he had been created in the first place. The voice told him that he, like all souls, had been created for love, and only love, and that the secret to life was to remember while on earth that our souls are made to love. Where do you come from? We come from love. And where are you going? We are going home to love. And the secret that is in the between of our coming and our going, that we learn how to love in the midst and in spite of the violence on this earth. I now invite Jan Reinson and Mary Ellen Campbell to come forward to lead us in a lamentation on violence so that we can begin to take the first step by acknowledging the violence in our society, our lives, and our hearts.
We remember the violated woman of Judges 19, and we give voice to her sorrow and her strength. We honor her struggle for protection and rights in a patriarchal system that did not acknowledge her personhood. We remember all of the strong and courageous women of Scripture. We give thanks for Deborah, Ruth, Rahab, Vashti, Esther, Mary Elizabeth, Mary of Magdala, Joanna, Dorcas, Lydia, and Priscilla, and others through history who lived in turbulent times. We lament their struggles and celebrate their strengths. We give thanks that in your heart of grace, all found shelter and a refuge, that in you there is always room for all.
We remember and lament the tragedy of the 14 women killed at the hands of violence while studying at École Polytechnique in Montreal, December 6, 1989, and for all young people whose lives have been lost at schools around the world, in Canada, in the U.S., in the Middle East, in Africa, Russia, in Europe, in India, lives lost needlessly through hatred and violence. We remember the Indigenous children of Canada who endured abuses in residential schools. We lament their loss of personhood and culture. And we work for a world in which children and youth and young people are safe at school, that there is room for all. We sing a song of lament for all those victims of violence that have gone missing either by their own hand or the hands of others.
We remember all of the Indigenous women and men whose lives have been abruptly cut off without a trace. We remember the Chinese in Canada who are forced to live as slaves underneath the streets of Moose Jaw, and the Japanese Canadians who are forced to leave their homes and live in internment camps in World War II. We sing this song of lamentation for all those who have lived lives of oppression because of race or religion, sexuality or gender. We acknowledge their struggle and honor their memory and trust that beneath your wings, O Creator, there is room for all.
We remember all people who have suffered at the hands of abuse of their parents or partners or friends. We lament all those whose lives have been scarred because of family violence in their own homes. We regret words spoken with harshness or in anger in our own families and seek to make amends. If we have contributed to the violence in our world, we regret those unjust actions and ask for grace as we all recommit ourselves anew to working toward a community of truth, reconciliation, and nonviolence. Empower each of us to be makers of peace, especially amidst the violence of our times. We sing a song of hope that, like you, our community of faith will make room for all.